on stage rocking out stir crazy.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I'm going to be doing a live remote this tomorrow evening, 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Yeah, 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Mandela Barnes's campaign office. We're going to be doing this live remote. I'm really excited about it. It's election eve. So it's Monday. Mondays with Sandy Williams. Let's go to the phone lines. And Dave, hey Dave, how you doing? Thank you very much for the call. You say what?
Hey Earl, I heard you guys talking about the gun problem, and I just had the call to share something I learned. If you recall, about a month ago, the former Prime Minister of Japan was assassinated by a homemade handgun, and someone wrote an article about the gun violence problem in Japan. And do you know what the statistics are for 2021 gun fatalities in Japan?
Well, I think
five.
Yeah, it was probably single digit.
Yeah.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah, and non-fatal shootings was 9. And they are a population of over 125 million. So this article talked about the guns are not banned. Hunting weapons, everyone can get hunting weapons. They can get rifles and shotguns. Handguns are banned. But to get a hunting weapon, a person would have to go through a lengthy training session that is repeated. I don't know if it's annually or every few years. They have to go through training, and also they go through an extensive background check that includes interviews with their family members and neighbors to assess, to find out their opinion on the fitness of that person to protect, to get a firearm. So that's how they deal with it. And I think it's pretty remarkable that 125 million people, there's one gun death for an entire year.
You know, Dave, I heard something, might have been yesterday, might have even been this morning's news, another record-breaking year for gun purchases, in this society. This can be fixed.
And that number was, I'm sure, in the millions.
Yes, in the millions.
In the millions of guns in a year purchased,
Sandy, though, this can be fixed, right?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, that's the problem with it is that when you look at how much the genie is out of the bottle, without us turning around and actually recovering guns that are already out there in circulation, like I said, I think the number is in excess of 400 million guns that are in private possession and that there are 20 million assault rifles in private possession. So, the genie's out of the bottle. And the ability to reverse, those guns will be in circulation. There's more than one gun per capita in circulation right now. I don't know how many of those are shotguns and how many are pistols, but I'm almost certain that the majority of those are pistols.
How does more guns make us safer? Like the parade shooting, a guy is on the roof. How is you holding a gun going to protect you from getting hit by a sniper? It's a surprise factor,
absolutely.
Guy who went in and shot up the police station, you've got a police station full of cops. They were helpless.
Yeah.
In a way,
it's the surprise factor.
In a way, the response to this problem in the United States is a bit like our response to the war in Ukraine, which is send in more armaments.
Yeah,
that's the answer. It's a sort of an admission that we have warfare, And now the answer to warfare is, well, just let's arm the good guys more than the bad guys, which isn't going to be a solution when the problem we've got is the willful use of guns by some people and the surprise factor for that matter as well. I mean, someone pops up with a gun, it's going to be a surprise.
But Sandy.
And the surprise means that you having a gun isn't necessarily going to help you.
But Sandy, the simplistic answers, the good guys and the bad guys.
I know.
I mean, you have the conversation.
Well, I mean, I know, but that's an admission that we have warfare.
A good guy with a gun. Come on, man.
That just assumes that bad guys. I mean, the whole thing is premised on a principle that most countries wouldn't allow to exist, which is that we've got that like essentially everyone in this country should have guns.
Right. Well, but we already know that two-thirds of the American people don't have them.
Yeah.
So, and that's the part that always gets me, Dave. We know that the majority of the American people don't have guns. So if the majority of the American people don't have guns, and people can look that up, that's not my statistic, why is it that we allow the one-third of the people to win this argument? I don't understand that. The majority usually wins in almost everything in this country. Why in this case?
Well, no, let's talk about that, because I think it has to do with the willfulness of the essentially the lobby of the people. So because the majority of people in this country favor choice with respect to a woman's ability to control her reproductive system and her body. But so far, at least, they're losing in the political battle associated with that issue. And guns are clearly that. I mean, I don't know what the data is exactly, but you're right that certainly everybody in this country does not have a gun, but the political power associated with the so-called Second Amendment right is unbelievable.
So, Sandy, you talked about, and we can't go past this, lobbyists and the power that they have outstrips the power of the electorate. Is that what we're saying?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, there's something seriously wrong with that.
Well, but that's clearly the case when you look into legislation and you see what gets passed in Congress and what doesn't get passed and what the public opinion is with respect to an issue and what actually gets accomplished. Because the public opinion has long been that we have a serious problem with our health care. But our ability to actually move all the way to a solution to our healthcare problem is impeded by the fact that healthcare is fraught with lobbying activity and the power of lobbyists. And the same is true with respect to prescription drugs and prescription drug costs. It's true with respect to almost everything.
So, Dave, thank you very much for the call. Really appreciate it. Sandy, I can't now move from that, right? I wanted to go somewhere else. But I can't move from what you just said. People, the impact of the lobbyists. And you know, we're talking about, well, election's out tomorrow. Everybody, we got to go vote and vote in the midterms and the midterms this and the midterms that. And all of those things mean nothing if you can't get your representative to do what you elected them for.
Well, they certainly they mean something, but they mean much less.
Yeah.
Mean much less than they should. They do mean something with respect to the social issues.
Yeah, I'll retract that.
Yeah, it means something, but the extent to which it means is severely restricted by money in politics, and money in politics is a broad term that includes the power of lobbyists, the power of special interests, private interests, and all of that is, it's clear that in our system right now, special interests and private interests have far too much influence as compared to the influence of Tom, Dick, and Mary.
So Sandy, you have to ask the next question after that. They're certainly not going to give that power up willingly. It's beneficial to that group that you just talked about.
Yeah.
And so how is there ever going to be a coming to Jesus moment in the society. If nothing else, we see it gets worse and worse. You know, anytime it, you know, you can spend $12 million to run for to become a United States senator, and this is in the not the, what's the word I'm looking for? Easy word, man.
Well, without finding that word, I would answer the question you haven't finished by by suggesting that Tom from Los Angeles was on the phone once with CJ, I think at the same time, and the two of them reached agreement on one issue, which is that there's too much influence of money in politics.
Right.
And I suspect the way this could be accomplished is the progressive movement would narrow the field of issues that they decided to address publicly in their presentation to something as simple as let's handle money in politics. And we might find that there would be a broad coalition politically that would cross party lines and would even cross the ideological lines of conservative and liberal agreement on that issue. If we could get agreement on that issue and get profound action to restrict it, we might then find that the people's voice would, when enlarged, would actually allow for a coalescence of interests that would get things accomplished, because it might overcome so that this majority of people who are worried about health care might actually have the sway to do something with about health care and politics. And it might actually bring people like CJ and Tom into agreement on enough things that were important. Because I think they both agree on prescription drugs. I know CJ talks about
right.
prescription drugs. So, I mean, in spite of personalizing this down to just a couple of these callers, I think it's clear to me that it can happen. It's just a question of whether there's a discipline on the side of, for instance, the progressive movement to take a single issue on, a single very important issue, linchpin issue, and see if we can't get a movement behind it.
Well, Sandy, somebody organized and brought the money into politics. It's always been there, but to the degree that it's there now. And so either we were asleep,
well, I
or the people who really thought this thing through.
Well, the problem is that Citizens United, those kind of things can be done by a fairly small and concerted but willful interest group who decides what kind of lawsuits might make sense to bring, and so that's a much less expensive effort that requires fewer.
Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. So, who's this? Implicit Cam. All right. Welcome back to the Early Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number, and so Sandy, Ukraine continues the war in Ukraine and Russia. There's an explosion next to a
nuclear plant
that in either side is saying the other guy did it, and they're talking about the impact. Could eventually wind up like a nuclear explosion.
Well, I think Amnesty International has gone in and has pointed out that the Ukrainians have been harboring troops and military personnel
in and
amongst civilian places,
right.
Apartment houses and shopping malls, etc.
Which is done throughout wars all the time.
Yeah, it's done in wars for the very purpose that we're now describing.
Right.
And the Russians are doing the same thing. They're harboring troops in and near this nuclear plant in order to make it impossible to shoot at them without endangering the nuclear plant.
Right.
So then the question becomes just the analysis of the incident, who fired the rocket that caused the problem at the nuclear plant? Was it Ukrainians or Russians? They're both pointing fingers at one
right.
another. I shake my head and say, I don't
who
know.
Who cares?
No, I do care, but it's sort of a who knows, and in a war this stuff is going to happen. And the problem I see, and I sort of put now Taiwan and Ukraine a little bit together, because Ukraine is the object lesson for us with respect to Taiwan. We're in Ukraine, and we stopped asking ourselves, why are we in Ukraine? How did we get there? Which is the important question, right? And now we're just looking at day-to-day issues and interest and information about what's happening in this war. And here we are in Taiwan at the very point where why we're here and how do we get and what could this lead to and why are we here and why are we taking these positions is of fundamental importance, because if we ever get Taiwan to the same position Ukraine is in, we have really got ourselves a problem.
So you brought Taiwan into it. I was going to talk about Taiwan. How do you pronounce it again? Taiwan. I was going to bring it in as a separate discussion, but they are kind of married together. When you look at what's happening right now in Taiwan and China's response to Nancy Pelosi wanting to come and clearly stick a finger in the eye of China,
yeah,
and say, hey, we're going to do what we want to do. We're the United States of America. And we have an obligation to Taiwan that we are going to protect them. Come on. Well, they're not going to war. And China is sending this message. Do you see this? They're sending this to Taiwan. Do you see this?
Well, they're sending the message to the
United States, right.
Well, I mean, but the fact is that the situations obviously are different, but there's a great deal of similarity between them. The situation in Ukraine, if we continue to look back at, okay, why did it get here and how did we participate in that and why did we do that? You know, the question of why, it becomes much more difficult to answer in Ukraine, and it's also very difficult to answer in China. And I think the main reason is because our domestic politics, we talk about foreign affairs and our domestic politics in ways that have nothing to do with our real critical interest or our real intent in the international affairs. It has to do with machismo and issues within American politics, which create terrible problems. So, you know, in America, in domestic politics, it was very important for some reason to be anti-Russian. And I think that had to do with a Russophobia, a fear of Russia that was generated out of the Cold War and was in many respects a knee-jerk. It was an instinctive reaction. So beginning in about 2008, and from then on, we began to readopt this anti-Russian view of things, which prompted Russia to become very concerned about us. And we began to sponsor and foster this expansion of NATO into areas that were designed to actually to make Russia nervous. There had been an agreement in 1991 between Gorbachev and George Bush the First to basically keep the old Warsaw Pact, the Iron Curtain countries, and the old USSR republics neutral in terms of not being made a part of NATO. And yet, very soon after that, in 1998 and 2004, we made all these countries parts of NATO. China, let's go back there. In China, in 1979, we signed a treaty with the People's Republic of China.
One China policy.
In which we agree to a one China policy, which means that Formosa, Taiwan, is a part of China. And ever since 1979, we've been sort of reneging on that treaty, mainly from the standpoint of domestic politics, in which domestically we talk about Taiwan like it's a separate country, a separate democracy. Incidentally, it wasn't a democracy until 1999. It was an autocracy. And it's now become much more of a democracy since 1999. But it's not exactly the model of democracy, even at this point. And so we began to walk back from that treaty by talking about Taiwan, by arming Taiwan, by talking about it as an independent nation, how we'd stand behind it. All this machismo talk within the United States domestic politics all the time, maintaining this policy with China that we called deliberate ambiguity, that was honoring the one China policy. So internationally, we've attempted to tell China that we mean it. We're you know, but then fundamentally, we begin to take actions that suggest we don't mean it. And having Nancy Pelosi go to Taiwan and visit at a time when they've just elected someone who, instead of the Kuomintang, which was the party in power of Taiwan, was a party that claimed that it had power over all of China, and that was frustrated by our 1979 treaty. But it always recognized that Taiwan was a part of China, and it was asserting its power over all of China, just the way the People's Republic was. So I'm just saying, we're doing the same thing in China that we did in Ukraine. It was a mistake in Ukraine, but a war with Taiwan, between Taiwan and China, is going to be a horrific thing, and it'll be horrific for U.S. policy if we try to isolate China.
You know, Sandy, all of what you just said, the American people need to be aware of, and we need to be focused on it. And it doesn't need to just be something that was said and then we don't talk about it anymore. China's not doing what they're doing right now for any other reason. As you stated, send a message to the United States, but the American people need to take that heed. They need to heed that message.
Yes.
The average American citizen needs to be the one who focuses on this and asks the questions about it. Because in the end, this is a serious, serious situation. Got to go to a break. Phone lines open, 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. And our guest is Mr. Max Richman. He is the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Hey, Max, how you doing, my friend? It's always good to hear from you.
I'm doing great. How are you, Earl?
I'm doing just fine, Max.
Good.
When you call, there's something that's in the works that people in this country should be leery of. And you know, we just had you on several weeks ago, but Ron Johnson did what Ron Johnson does. And all I thought about when Ron Johnson made the statements that he made, you know, about the fact that Social Security and Medicare needs to be rethought, relooked at each year. I thought about you. Let's talk about what's going on.
You know, I read news accounts of the senator's comments about Social Security, and you know, out of respect for the office, I thought, well, he's misinformed, but he really doesn't know what he's talking about, to be blunt about it. Social Security is not an entitlement. You know that.
You're right.
most people know that. It's an earned benefit. And that is a very important distinction between something that is an earned benefit and something that's an entitlement. People that are working know that they're making a contribution. It's withheld out of their paycheck every time they get paid to the Social Security program. They're buying insurance for disability, survivor benefits, children's benefits, and yes, for retirement when they reach eligibility age. So, you know, the fact that he characterizes this program, and he should know better, as something other than an earned benefit, that tells me he really doesn't know what he's talking about when it comes to Social Security. And can you imagine, you know how hard it is to get anything through the Congress these days? If we had to start each year and reinvent Social Security and get it approved and get it adequately funded, people would be waiting on pins and needles for the Congress to act to see if they're going to get their Social Security benefit check. So it's about one of the worst ideas that's come along when it comes to Social Security in a long time. And as I said, he really
He really should know better. He's been in the Senate now for a couple of terms. He should know better.
So Max, why would a guy who's fighting for his political life not understand that this is something that the timing couldn't be worse? If ever there was the bad time to even say this, is it again, as you just stated, you said because he doesn't know any better? He's got to be more politically savvy than that,
yeah.
Shouldn't he?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know him. But the fact that he would make that kind of a comment, and you're right, he's running for re-election. My understanding that he may be the most vulnerable incumbent Republican senator running for re-election this November. So you would think people around him would at least tell him, you ought to be really careful when you start talking about Social Security, because guess what? Seniors vote in huge numbers. And that's going to be critical in November in his reelection. So, our job, and thanks to you, we get a chance to magnify our view, is to let people know he's wrong about this. I haven't seen any ads about it, but I imagine you'll see them soon out there. But he's wrong. This program was created in 1935. Everybody that's ever been eligible to receive benefits has received them on time, in full. So the program has to be updated, and you and I have talked about some of the changes that have to be made. There have been no major changes for nearly 50 years, so it's time to upgrade the program, but to put it out in the legislative process every year to reinvent it, that's a huge mistake.
So Ron Johnson is feeling the heat already. A spokesperson for Johnson's office quickly clarified that the senator was not suggesting putting Medicare and Social Security on the chopping block, according to a report by The Hill. Instead, it would mean the programs are up for reevaluation annually. What is the difference?
Well, there is no. That's a difference without a distinction. And he's not alone, by the way. His fellow colleague, Senator Scott, Rick Scott of Florida, who also ought to know better, he has a plan, and this is a senator that's in charge of electing and reelecting Republicans to the Senate. He has a plan that Social Security, Medicare, other programs should be what he calls sunsetted. In other words, they end every 5 years, and we start all over again to see if we're going to reauthorize them, change them. But they're sunsetted, and that's a kind of a fancy way of saying the program ends unless the Congress acts and the president signs legislation to keep them going. It's a pattern. It's a pattern of undermining and attacking the Social Security program. And it's these two senators, Senator Mitt Romney of Utah. He has a plan that's been out there for a couple of years, and he calls it the Trust Act. Sounds good, right? Trust? That sounds like a good thing. What his plan would do is he would set up a special committee, a trust committee, to look at changes to Social Security and Medicare, expedite the process, sidestep the way things are usually done through committee work and legislation, allow for a plan to change. And I think when he talks about changing it, he's talking about cutting it. Cutting the program, no amendments allowed, no public input, no hearing process, and it's another way to undermine the program. This is not new. I'm sure you remember when President Bush was reelected, I remember it very well when he was reelected in 2004. We were sitting in our conference room, the staff and I, and he, the day after he was reelected, he came out to the podium, and first words out of his mouth was, "I've been reelected. I have a mandate, and I'm going to use that to privatize Social Security." Remember that?
Yes.
Traveled all over the country, 30 town hall meetings in 30 days to privatize Social Security. That plan collapsed. Could not even get a vote on that plan in the Congress. And he had a Republican House of Representatives at that time. But so I'm just saying this. These proposals keep surfacing, and they often sound kind of innocuous, you know, privatize, sunset these programs, the Trust Act, reevaluate, your senator, Ron Johnson, has talked about reevaluate these programs every year. The bottom line is we're going to cut benefits. We're determined to cut benefits. And we have some fancy ways of talking about it.
So Max, before I need to introduce my co-host on Mondays and Fridays, Sandy Williams, and what Sandy Williams constantly talks about is the dangers of the safety net being taken away in this country. Sandy?
Well, I do think Social Security and Medicare should be and probably are in a way political third rails, and that there's so many people dependent on them that do vote that as President Bush found out when he tried to think that the 401k could replace the Social Security benefits. But we do have a problem with Social Security, and that is that while it was set up to be talked about like it was a fund, it wasn't set aside like a trust fund, and it didn't accumulate money, so that FICA has been used on an ongoing basis to generate the cash revenue necessary to pay out Social Security. But then the cash that was derived from that was in excess was essentially used by the federal government to defray its other cash requirements. So we do face the prospect going forward of FICA having to be increased materially in order to support Social Security payments. So I'd be interested in how we do that and what is the process.
Max, hold the thought.
Yes.
Got to go to the break. 844-967-2789, my guess is Max Richmond. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us that same number as Mondays. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We are joined by my good friend Max Richmond. He's the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. And before we went to break, Max, you wanted to respond to what Sandy had to say.
Well, yeah, let me just elaborate a little bit on that question. So I was asking you, Max, how is it that because the money collected for Social Security under the FICA tax wasn't collected in a fund and put aside, but was rather has always been used for current purposes, so we end up today with the need to increase taxes to support Social Security to those who have paid into Social Security in the past substantial sums of money. And it seems to me that the Republicans or the conservatives who want to have lower taxes and worry about so-called entitlements have been setting the stage for this conflict by reducing taxes and setting the stage for the time when there will have to be an increase in taxes to support Social Security and Medicare, and they can pit the taxpayer against the beneficiaries of those two social programs. So I wondered, what's the strategy going forward?
Right. Well, Sandy, there's a lot to unpack there, but let me just first try to clarify a little bit the way the program is financed. There is a payroll tax, a dedicated revenue stream used to pay Social Security benefits. Back in the last time the Congress addressed Social Security in any comprehensive way in the early 80s, There were some changes made to the program. The payroll tax was increased a little bit. The age for receiving benefits was, over a long period of time, increased from 65 to 67. All that was done to build up the Social Security Trust Fund. Money that's paid into the program in excess of what is needed to pay benefits, it's not accurate that it's used for other purposes. The way it works, that money is invested in treasury bills held by the Social Security program. These are not, as some have characterized them, little slips, IOUs. You know, they're not little slips of paper, as much as I regard Earl. They're not little slips of papers with Earl Ingram on them. They're treasury bills. So that's what the program has. And those are rolled over almost every day and redeemed, earn interest, not the best interest available, but the soundest investment, because they are in treasury bills. So to give you one example, during the pandemic, because of the unemployment we were experiencing, less money came into the program for a couple of years than was needed to pay everybody their full benefits. But everybody did get their full benefits because the bonds didn't even have to be redeemed. The interest on the bonds was enough to make up the shortfall for the money that was coming into the program through the payroll tax. And the size of the trust fund actually grew, even though we were experiencing economic dislocation.
So what is the size of that trust fund?
Pardon me?
What is the size of that trust fund? How many?
$2.9 trillion.
Okay.
You put your finger on what the real issue is, and that is how do we keep the program sound for a long period of time? Right now, the trustees they report every spring the program is able to pay everybody their full benefits. This is not according to Max Richmond, it's the trustees of Social Security, until 2035. It was extended by 1 year from the previous year's report. Now, in 2035, we're going to have a problem, a serious problem, because the program, the money that comes in, the trust fund, all those, that $2.9 trillion will be used. There will only be enough money coming in to pay about 77% of the benefits that people are due. This does not mean the program is bankrupt, there's no money there, it was stolen, all of that baloney. It just means there's a shortfall, and a serious shortfall. What can we do about it? We can bring more revenue into the program in a fair way. As I've talked to Earl about before, there's a cap on wages subject to the payroll tax. It changes a little bit every year. This year, it's $147,000 in wages. After that, no more payroll tax. Why? We would support eliminating that cap. President Biden has pledged not to raise taxes on anybody earning less than $400,000 a year. So the plan we support would keep the cap on taxes on wages subject to payroll tax at what it is, 147. It changes a little bit every year. Start collecting payroll tax on wages at $400,000 and above. This would impact a tiny, tiny sliver of wage earners who could afford to pay, in my opinion, a little bit more to make sure the program is sound way beyond 2035. So that's the plan. There's a bill that we support introduced in the House by Congressman John Larson of Connecticut. He's the chairman of the Social Security Subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee. He has 203 co-sponsors. I think I'm going to actually see him tonight, I believe, and the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and we're hoping to get that bill out of the committee and pass the House right after Labor Day. So that, in my mind, is a fair way to keep the program sound beyond 2035. We have to do something, because I think even Ron Johnson, even Senator Johnson would, I think, say we cannot cut Social Security benefits in 12 years by 22%. That's not acceptable. So I think the fair way to extend the solvency of the program is to bring a little more revenue into it in a fair and responsible way, and I think the plan I've talked about does that.
Sandy?
No, that answers my question, and I think it clarifies a point with respect to how the Social Security funds are currently sequestered. I do believe that somehow the government is able to access it for the purpose of solving its own cash borrowing requirements, but beyond this conversation.
Well, by its nature, but I think the way that's characterized can be misleading. We've heard for years there's no money there. The government was stolen. The money was stolen. The government's using it for other purposes. Yes, we don't have. You remember when George Bush was working on privatizing the program? He had a prop. He went to some vault in West Virginia and opened it, and there was it wasn't $2.9 trillion. It was about half that at the time. There was no money in there. It would not make sense. And I think everybody understands this, to have $2.9 trillion in cash
right. Sitting
somewhere. You invest it in the soundest investment possible, treasury bills. You don't earn the best interest possible, but it's the safest investment. And if you look at it that way, that money is used when the bonds are issued, the cash is used
for the government
or whatever the government needs government.
Yeah.
But it's not stolen. It is backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
Yeah,
and that is through U.S. Treasury bills.
Yeah, I mean, what I said earlier was an economist's oversimplification of it, and it does have that interest aspect to it, which is a bit like a COLA adjustment. But so the cash flow does go to the benefit of the government during the period of excess FICA payments. But
it's repaid.
Yes, and it's repaid.
Yep.
So yes, I do understand. I think I understood it in a foggy fashion, but thank you for the clarification.
Well, thank you for the question, because it allowed me to elaborate on, you know, some of the common misunderstandings about the program.
You know, Max, clearly, Ron John, this is not going anywhere, right? I mean, it's not going anywhere.
I hope not.
You used it. You threw in hope.
Yeah, I hope not, and you know, we'll see if Ron Johnson's a U.S. senator next January.
Well, I don't think he's going to be. I personally don't think he's going to be. I know it's not going to be an easy fight, but the guy who he's running against, there are people in this state, both Democrat and Republican, who have basically had enough of Ron Johnson. He's done some things that warrant him being removed from the Senate, and hopefully that's going to happen.
Well, I met your Lieutenant Governor
Mandela Barnes.
I met him in Wisconsin a couple years ago. We were doing some forums on prescription drug costs with AARP, and he came. I had not heard of him, but he made a presentation, and he was terrific. I mean, just
yeah, he is. Max, we got to run. Thank you as always for keeping us informed.
Thank you, Earl.
All right, we'll
you
talk
take
soon.
Care.
All right, that's Max Richmond.
Bye bye.
Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. Dave from Mequon, hang on or call back after the break. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Mondays with Sandy Williams. We'll be back. Oh, man.